Hawaii, Tokyo, Australia, Germany.
Go head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Here we go. It is six. It is 1.5 minutes past 6 p.m. We're live. This is the Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home. That's where you go if you want to jump into the chat room and be part of the real-time multimedia madcap zany extravaganza that is the conversation that takes place during the 3 hours of the program is live each and every day. You go to headonradionetwork.com, you click chat room, and you pick yourself out a screen name and a password, and of course, hopefully, you're not trying to deal with, you know, navigate Java through an Apple machine unless you know, like, all the secret magic whiz-bang things you have to do to get that to happen. But once you get in, you'll be greeted by, well, a merry little band to begin things this evening. More will be along presently, but Hoghead's there and Jug of Punch is there waiting for you, as is longtime inveterate, indefatigable veteran chat room moderator Sparky, who, being a third-stage guild navigator with a lot of common sense, has not folded space to become Man Cave because, well, it's hotter. It is hotter in the Man Cave right now than in the furthest reaches of the Arakeen Desert. Yes. So jump on in, and of course, I would be remiss, and we would not long be on the air if I did not mention, also, that this is a listener-supported broadcast experiment that's been going on for some years. Oh, hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. Thank you, Marty, for the reminder. And we've got no ads here. Sorry, we just don't. So we rely on listener contributions. And we got one of those last night. Thank you very kindly to Don for signing up for a brand new subscription. And let me add at this point in time that, I looked at things, and the last week or so of the month is absolutely our worst time for subscriptions. They dwindle to something approaching nil over the last 4 to 5 days of the month. Last night, though, we got a good bit of help. Thank you to Brenda, as well as to Randy, and to our buddy Philip over there in Maryland. Doing the math in my head as we go. Thanks to Joyce. And thanks very kindly to our buddies at Bomasa. So, you know what that means? Well, we ended the program last night in a $390 fundraising hole. Well, $190. It's $390. It would have been $390 today. But because of all that, now it is just, let me see, again with the math, it is $343. Or, no, $243. No, 343. 343, yes. See, it's me and the math. Math is hard, okay? For former English majors, math is hard. $343 is the fundraising goal for the evening. That's one at 343. Oh, really? Really? That number. That's 150, 170. Two at 170, 150, and I refuse to cheat and use a calculator from there on out, but also 10 at $34.30 and 34.3 people at $10 a piece. That's how we get everything to square on this here Titanic Tuesday, the 23rd day of August, 2016. Also, a little reminder, I'm trying to hold the wild rice offer open as long as I possibly can, but I got to get it out of here. I got to get it off to my buddies in the Northwoods. So if you've been thinking maybe you want to get your hands on some of the wild rice, I got to hear from you by no later than tomorrow. All right? And remember, the way that works, if you want 2 pounds, and that'll do you a couple of feasts or one really big family. Go to PayPal, and the contribution's $100. If you only want one, $60, and we'll go from there and make sure that I have a good mailing address. Okie doke, okie doke. Jug of Punch in the chat room asking, how does one become a former English major? One graduates. Once one has been an English major and then has then graduated, one then becomes a practitioner of the art of word knowing. So that's how that works. Okay. So there we go. The fundraising goal just dropped with a very kind helping out from a Nani Moose, and there'll be a couple of pounds of wild rice winging toward the great middle of the country, and I know somebody that's going to enjoy it very, very much. So we got that. And so the fundraising goal just dropped to $243 for the evening. But seriously, if you want to in on this, you got to let me know quick. I mean, maybe I can get more, but this is happening like tomorrow. Can't wait anymore. So okay, we've taken care of all of that. Now. It is, of course, I remind us all, Titanic Tuesday. Titanic Tuesday, you might remember, is named for something that happened many, many years ago now in America's fifth smallest radio market, Beckley, West Virginia, when one of America's great underappreciated monotones was reading the newspaper to his little cadre of knuckle walking, mouth breathing wing nuts, and one of them called in and said, "Steve, how come is it that they is seashells in the rocks in West Virginia? We ain't nowhere near the beach." To which he replied, "Well, caller, that's because of the movement of the Titanic plates." And you know, the stentorian authority that cloaked those words was something for the ages. No irony, no laughter. Deadly in earnest, the movement of the Titanic plates. I mean, this guy had less modulation in his voice than Lurch. Mm-hmm. But so that's where it comes from, and meanwhile, while we know it's from the movement of the Titanic plates, well, we still have we have no word on the movement of the Titanic tablecloth clips. Do you realize that over the years this table has become about the size of the Titanic itself? Yes. So we celebrate great moments in right-wing determination to steer headlong into disaster each and every Tuesday. And today is no different. Save for the fact that we're going to begin Titanic Tuesday with a couple of nominations for the for-profit media. But then again, they're owned by right-wingers in the first place now, so it's not like we're really veering too far off our initial brief. Here's the headline. Obama tours Louisiana amid criticism that he's late. Okay? Obama tours Louisiana amid criticism that he's late. This comes to us from the journalistic geniuses at Chicken Noodle News. Now, let's be clear. When the flooding when the flooding began and people began to realize how awful it was going to be in Louisiana, one of the first things that John Bel Edwards, the governor of Louisiana, did was to say publicly that he hoped President Obama would not come down there anytime soon because, well, a presidential visit, given all the pomp and circumstance that attends it, whether the president is a Republican or a Democrat, creates a logistical nightmare for law enforcement wherever the president goeth. And so what Governor Edwards said kind of made sense. It's a disaster area in the first place, so why would you complicate matters when law enforcement is up to its trigger-happy knuckles in attempting to, you know, protect and serve people for a change? Man, am I a dick or what? I'm not damning with faint praise. Sheesh. Yeah, I'm going to give myself one of these.
You dick!
Yeah, I deserved it too. That was just awful. So the Obama administration complied with the stated wishes of the chief executive of the little nation state of Louisiana Stan. And, you know, I take it as gospel that all presidential visits to everywhere are given tremendous security scrutiny. And some places maybe, nowhere is deemed to be completely safe for the president, because paranoia is the business of the Secret Service. But the fact of the matter is, when you're going into a place like Louisiana Stan or Talabama or South Carolina Stan, or God knows Arizona Stan, it's probably a little more dangerous. And a little bit more has to go into it than, say, a visit to, you know, New York or Minnesota. But I'm just guessing at that. So President Obama stayed away. Governor John Bel Edwards really didn't want anybody with any entourages or posses showing up, but that didn't slow down the great big steaming orange pile of shit known as Donald J. Trump, billionaire who owns a mansion and a yacht. He went down with a truckload of stuff, he said that he had given, and handed out Play-Doh for a little while. 29 minutes, I think, was the exact measure of time. And later on, it turned out that his claim that that was his truck and his stuff and he gave direct money of his own, the Washington Post started digging around on it, and lo and behold, nah, it's probably bullshit. It's probably just another Mar-a-Lago Mussolini manufactured pile of crap. But he went down regardless of the wants or needs or desires of the people who are trying to aid in the recovery effort. And the recovery effort is damned well still going on. And so, when enough time had passed that it would not be complete chaos for President Obama to go down there, lo and behold, we get this headline from CNN, as mentioned previously: Obama tours Louisiana amid criticism that he's late, by Theodore Schlieffer, Ali Malloy, and Nick Valencia at CNN. This is CNN. So, being as how it was updated at 3:49 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, I went and had a look to find out who was criticizing President Obama that he was late. Guess what I found? It starts out with a couple of quotes from President Obama. And then the third paragraph says, "The flooding has created political headache for the," not apolitical or the political, just, you know, because copy editing is so just not done. "The flooding has created political headache for the White House as critics blasted Obama for being slow to visit the state." Now, okay, we're beginning to get a clue three paragraphs in, because, what's their name again? Because Theodore Schlieffer, Ali Malloy, and Nick Valencia have declared, have used the plural version of the word, the noun, critic. They have said, in fact, that critics blasted Obama for being too slow to visit the state. The use of the plural indicates, because I am a longtime practitioner of the art of word knowing, it indicates that there's more than one critic. And we have to operate, this isn't algebra or higher math, there are no fractions, there's not 1.01 critics, it's at least two critics. So, what do you get? "The flooding has created political headache for the White House as critics blasted Obama for being too slow to visit the state. He spent the previous week vacationing on Martha's Vineyard, while Republican presidential Donald Trump and his vice presidential running mate, Mike Pence, visited the state and handed out supplies." Okay, so we're still don't know who the multiple critics are. We just know that TP, well, they, well, that, you know, Donald and Mike TP'd the state. "Tuesday's a little too late," Trump told Fox News this weekend. "Hop into the plane and go down and go to Louisiana and see what's going on, because it's a mess." The city's newspaper, The Advocate, originally criticized the president for not ending his vacation in Martha's Vineyard immediately to visit the region, but the editorial board praised his decision to come Tuesday. "We welcome news of President Barack Obama's planned visit to Louisiana today to survey flood damage, which should help to advance relief and recovery in the disaster area as a national priority." Trump's visit was well received by local officials, and for a moment it gave Trump a chance to so we're back to Trump again. And then John Bell Edwards says, "Because it helped shine a spotlight on Louisiana, on the dire situation we have here, it was helpful." Okay. I'm still trying to find that more than one critic. And we are lots of paragraphs into an article whose damn headline says there's criticism that he's late. What you have here is, well, I should probably have this as a stored clip. What we have here is failure to communicate. Because the headline should have actually read, Obama arrives in Louisiana. Idiots holler about arrival. Okay, that's not very artful. Obama goes to Louisiana as haters gonna hate. There, we're gonna that uses the modern vernacular a little more, doesn't it? Something like that. Obama goes to Louisiana. Usual suspects have hissy. Obama goes to Louisiana and just cover what Obama did. But you see, we are so, the for-profit media are so far lost in the great game of false duality and bullshit binaries that they are by now constitutionally, and I don't mean law, I mean constitution as in, you know, spiritual, physical, whatever. They are constitutionally incapable of just writing a simple news story about a president, a presidential visit. They just can't do it. Instead, we get bullshit like, okay. So the headline, nothing about the story indicates anything about Hillary Clinton, yet way down in the story we got, Hillary Clinton, Trump's Democratic opponent, said Monday that she too plans a trip to the flood site. Her campaign said in a statement that she would come to the state at an unspecified time in the future. This month's floods in Louisiana are a crisis that demand a national response. I am committed to visiting communities affected by these floods at a time when the presence of a political campaign will not disrupt the response to discuss how we can and will rebuild together. Oh, there it is. God, Sparky is so fast. Yeah. Okay. Oh, wrong button. That's... Sparky's fast. Me? I'm slow. See, this is the kind of thing that makes really hip, cool, happening progressive radio programs with tons and tons of money and that allow them to have huge staffs. This is what makes them so hip and happening. That you, somebody can say something and boom, right there it is. No, dummy, wrong button again. But you can't just let something this good go to waste. You just can't.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
And you know what? That's it. I mean, there's just failure to communicate all over this chicken noodle news piece. Okay, and then they stray completely away from the top. Obama's expected to meet Tuesday with family members of police officers killed in last month's Baton Rouge attack. Yada, yada, yada. And then we go back to talking about Obama's vacation. Yet his response has earned some comparisons to how George W. Bush handled another natural catastrophe in a Louisiana city, New Orleans, during Hurricane Katrina in 2005. Okay, If we apply the who, what, when, where, why, how, and how much rule of journalism to that paragraph, don't we at least deserve to know who it is that's comparing Barack Obama and George W. Bush? Well, apparently not. Because this is Titanic journalism. Titanic journalism. It cares not for the great hulking iceberg ahead. It flies on, but since we're going to mention George W. Bush going to New Orleans, we have to include it flies headlong into the iceberg to the merry strains of damn, where's Tim from LA? The Calliope music. God, this is pitiful. Let's see. So then we have a reference to a guy named Todd Critchell, who spoke to CNN's Nick Valencia on the scene. Who told Nick Valencia of CNN, I think it's great that Trump came into town to show his support. I think that's a good thing he did that, to tell you the truth. Albany, Louisiana's Catherine Murphy says, there ain't nothing he can do for us that Louisiana ain't done for ourselves. I got no help from the federal government. I ain't asking for help from the federal government. Baby, let me tell you, my community has come through. I think there's at least $147 million for cash payments in the pipeline that are already being, you know, paid out. She ain't got nothing from the federal government. No. So we got that. Meanwhile, a note from Jack in Shreveport, subject line Louisiana, and you know damn well that the filthy Republicans would accuse Obama of politicizing the event had he shown up immediately in Louisiana. No doubt they will still make that accusation anyway, now that he's shown up. And, you know, this whole presidential visits to disaster areas thing, by the way, and this is not a criticism, this is merely mentioning a fact. Back in the third week of June, the state of West Virginia got plumb slobber knocked by a 1,000-year flood. A couple of weeks later, my friends up in the north woods of Wisconsin, up in the Bad River area, they got plumb slobber knocked by a 1,000-year flood. No presidential visit. But there were declarations of disaster areas that allowed FEMA relief to flow. And that, in turn, is what mattered. But then there's a larger discussion to be had about exactly what FEMA relief actually means. And it has had the living guts slashed out of it by the Republicans over the years. No one can receive more than $33,000 in FEMA relief, and I don't know too many houses that can be rebuilt for that. God knows Tony Norman, yes, Mother Bates, Perkins' house can't be. He probably can't replace one flooded-out car for $33,000, but I'm sure he's applying. So, I'm at a loss. And you know, I used to work in the for-profit journalism industry. I mean, those were a couple of really interesting years at CNN. But this just beats all. I mean, it really, really does. They create a clickbait headline, and that is exactly and precisely all it was, designed to get supporters of Obama and opponents alike to click it so they can find out who it is they hate today. And then it turns out that it's the journalistic equivalent of what Gertrude Stein said about Oakland, California. There's no there there. And I've always thought she was wrong about that, by the way. And so let's move along from one for-profit media conglomerate owned by a massive right-wing corporation to another corporate media practitioner owned by a right-winger, Jeff Bezos from Amazon. This one's a couple of days old, but I gotta talk about it. Because this is such a beautiful little lesson. It is a column, an opinion piece, by Fareed Zakaria. And what it boils down to is it's sort of a critique slash review of a book by a man named J.D. Vance. And the title of the book is Hillbilly Elegy, A Memoir of a Family and Culture in Crisis. J.D. Vance apparently spent his formative years in Appalachistan. But because he worked hard and applied himself, he managed to get through the public school system and got himself the hell out of Appalachia. First, I think, at Ohio State University, and then I think maybe at either Harvard or Yale Law. And man, when he left Appalachia, he never stopped leaving. And he did a stint in the Marine Corps, and now he's some sort of corporate panjandrum in Silicon Valley. That part is really inconsequential. So what Fareed Zakaria does, and does well, I want to be absolutely clear on this point, what he does and does well is to analyze Hillbilly Elegy, A Memoir of a Family and Culture in Crisis, in conjunction with an attempt to understand the phenomenon of the Mar-a-Lago Mussolini's appeal among people in Appalachia. I mean, it is still gonna be a rat killing come November in this state where Hillary is concerned. I'm sorry, I screwed that up. Where the devil is concerned. I mean, it's worth the read. It was published this past weekend. Zakaria writes, We all now know that Trump's rise has been fueled by the alienation and anger of the country's white working class. That cohort has seen its income stagnate, cities crumble, and dreams vanish. But Vance gets underneath the data and shows us what these impersonal forces mean to actual people. He describes the abandoned children, the poor work habits, the drug abuse, the violence, the rage. But he does it all with sympathy and love. They are his family, after all. And so Fareed Zakaria writes, understandingly and both sympathetically. He quotes Vance saying, "We hillbillies must wake the hell up and stop blaming Obama or Bush or faceless companies and ask ourselves what we can do to make things better." His own life story, coming from low expectations, dysfunctional relationships, and persistent poverty to end up a graduate of Yale Law School and a Silicon Valley executive, demonstrates that grit can conquer all. Yeah. And here's where Zakaria gently slips the shiv in. But Vance got some help along the way. He tells us his public schools were decent enough, and when he got motivated, his teachers helped him succeed. And blah, 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 Ohio State, blah, 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 Marine Corps, blah, 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 law school. And Zakaria then says, "There is surely something else at work here. The sense that people who look and sound very different are rising up. Surveys, polls, and other research confirm that racial identity and anxiety are at the heart of support for Trump." Vance touches on this sideways when speaking about the almost pathological suspicion his hillbillies, have for Barack Obama. Vance explains that it is because of the president's accent, clean, perfect, neutral, his urban background, his success in the meritocracy, his reliability as a father, and no, this is where the shiv does the real work. And one wants to whisper to Vance, because he's black. After all, over the years, the white working class has voted for plenty of Republican and Democratic candidates with fancy degrees and neutral accents. That's not what makes Obama different. So, like I said, it's a good piece. It's all about how a white male Appalachian pulled himself up by his own bootstraps and was able to succeed by getting the hell out of Appalachia. Now, me, I take issue with this notion that he presents, and this is his quote again: "We hillbillies must wake the hell up and stop blaming Obama or Bush or faceless companies and ask ourselves what can we do to make things better." Well, J.D., sugar, let me explain you something. I have never, not once ever, set off the explosive force of 25 cruise missiles at one time in order to blow up a goddamn mountain. I have never, not once, sent clouds of poisonous, killing, toxic blasting dust and various crustal elements reduced to ultra-fine particulate matter, roiling, rolling, and boiling down a holler to be breathed by mommies, daddies, grammies, grandpas, kitties, cousins, aunts, uncles, babies, cats, dogs, beasts of the field. I have never done that. I have never poisoned a stream so thoroughly that the fish in it began to be hatched with twisted spines and split heads. We call that the Simpson fish around here, from the original credits to the Simpsons. You know, the little two-headed fish next to the nuclear plant that Homer works at. I've never done that. A faceless company, several faceless companies, however, have. And so, yeah, there is a place for blame in trying to sort out Appalachia's problems. Because if we do not isolate the causes of our agonies, if we do not identify the sources of our troubles, then what's to say we won't just perpetuate them? Because we probably will. I still intend to read this book. Granted, he's a Silicon Valley executive, but at some point in time, I'll put a little jingle in his pocket. Because I want to see how much of it jibes with my thinking. But onward then to the cause of this story actually being part of Titanic Tuesday. And it is this. The headline for this, and I guess we can say that this falls under the ongoing topic here of copy editing as a lost art. The headline reads, Trump, Hillbillies, and Race. That shouldn't even be a headline in the Fraser's Bottom, West Virginia, Morning Glory and Battle Cry of Freedom, let alone the Washington Post. Trump, Hillbillies, and Race. Now, the fact that the word hillbilly appears in the body of Fareed Zakaria's piece is entirely acceptable because it is used acceptably. He uses it because he quotes the title of the book that has the word hillbilly in it. The other time that he uses it, Fareed Zakaria, is when he is quoting J.D. Vance, who is talking about what hillbillies should or should not do, and J.D. Vance is a self-identified hillbilly. For the sake of clarity, I myself use the word hillbilly because it is self-referential. It is a word I use to describe not only myself, but people of this region, but it is, of course, a word that was coined outside this region and not by the people of this region and was used as a pejorative to describe the people of this region, a way to dismiss us, a way to minimize us, a way, in fact, to oppress us. But the copy editor decided to just refer to Appalachian people as hillbillies. Now, by way of showing how and why this is wrong, I may be working a little bit close to the edge here. So, let's say that some Vietnam veteran writes a memoir of his time in the jungles of Southeast Asia. And he titles the book using a vile pejorative term for Vietnamese people. I don't have to use the word. There are several, and you know all of them. So you just use one in your own, this being radio, in your own imagination there. And let's say that somebody at the Washington Post, say Fareed Zakaria, writes an opinion piece about it. In his new book, in his new memoir of his Vietnam experiences, Colonel Doofus writes in pejorative term, colon, my time in Vietnam. And nobody can complain about what Fareed Zakaria has done because he's giving the name of the book. Let's say then that the copy goes to the copy editor who writes the headline and then says, a colonel, comma, and then uses the pejorative term, and Vietnam. There's no way it would happen. Okay, a better example. One of the great, great writers in the English language did not start out writing in the English language. His name was Joseph Conrad. He's probably best known for Heart of Darkness, but he was wildly successful as a writer. He changed the way a lot of people think or thought about writing. And at one time, he wrote a book called The N-Word of the Narcissus. It was published the world over as exactly that. The title was changed to remove the N-word from the title in the United States, not because it was determined to be insulting, but because the publisher was fearful that all the white folks who bought books wouldn't buy a book about that word. So let's say that Fareed Zakaria writes a column about Donald Trump in relation to that more than 100-year-old novel by Joseph Conrad and race. And he quotes the title of the book, and it's entirely appropriate because that was the title of the book. But it gets to the copy editor, and the copy editor headlines it, Trump, N-words, and race. There would still be picketing going on outside the offices of the Washington Post. Because that word was coined not by the people to whom it is applied, not as a word of praise, not as anything except derision, dismissal, and oppression. And everybody understands that. It is apparently still difficult, although I should note, and you've heard it from time to time on this program, the word will be used by people whom it has heretofore been used against as a wry self-referent, as a means of trying to take the starch and the force and the sting out of it. It's exactly the same with hillbillies. No, not exactly the same. But it is similar enough that one would expect that by the time somebody gets to be a copy editor at the Washington Post, they would know better. But instead, we get an object lesson in what the Washington Post actually thinks of people that Hillary Clinton called those people a few short months back. And I mentioned this in conjunction with a bit of news. on this program, more than on any other, we have talked about mountaintop removal. I have been, other hosts of other programs and have been very kind in affording me and others an opportunity to try to describe to the outside world what is going on here. But this program, more than any other broadcast effort anywhere on earth, has tried to make mountaintop removal a reality. For people who do not either know what it is or live where it is. And so when something new comes along, I try to make sure that I share it. And something new has come along. Those of us who were instrumental in the founding and the work of the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Campaign, which resulted in the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Act being introduced in the Congress, and who continue to work toward passage of that landmark piece of legislation, have spent a lot of time coming trying to digest and understand a considerable body of scientific literature that shows, demonstrates the harm being caused by that practice here in what we refer to as the sacrifice zone. Central to a great deal of that research has been the work of a man that I consider to be a friend and a brilliant researcher by the name of Michael Hendricks. He was at West Virginia University, but now he's at Indiana University in Bloomington, where he is with the School of Public Health. It was Michael Hendricks who showed the massive birth defect disparities that Appalachian people are forced to deal with when they live near mountaintop removal. It was Michael Hendricks who showed that a woman who does not smoke but lives near mountaintop removal has a 187% greater chance of giving birth to a baby with respiratory birth defects than a woman who smokes like a chimney and lives nowhere near mountaintop removal. It's Michael Hendricks who helped show mortality, elevated mortality rates, elevated cancer rates, elevated heart disease rates. It was Michael Hendricks who showed that every year during the time that he was working, with the time period of the data with which he worked, that every year in West Virginia's mountaintop removal counties, there are 4,000 excess deaths. Someday, if we can ever manage to end this human rights disaster, we need to name a school or put up a statue or something for Michael Hendricks here, because it will largely be on his work that we finally came to our senses and realized what it was that was being done to the innocent victims who have to live with the predatory practices of the coal industry. And so now, he has a new paper out. He's the co-author of a new paper. It's called Unintended Consequences of the Clean Air Act, Mortality Rates in Appalachian Coal Mining Communities. It is summarized as follows. The 1990 amendments to the U.S. Clean Air Act encouraged the growth of mountaintop removal coal mining in central Appalachia. This study tests the hypothesis that the amendments had unintended impacts on increasing mortality rates for populations living in these mining areas. We used a panel design to examine adjusted mortality rates for three groups: all-cause respiratory cancer and non-cancer respiratory disease, between 1968 and 2014, in 404 counties stratified by MTR and Appalachian non-Appalachian status. The results showed significant interactions between MTR status and post-Clean Air Act period for all three mortality groups. These differences persisted after control for time, age, smoking rates, poverty, obesity, and physician supply. The MTR region in the post-Clean Air Act years experienced an excess of approximately 1,200 adjusted deaths per year. Let that sink in. Although the Clean Air Act has benefits, energy policies have in general focused on the combustion portion of the fossil fuel cycle. Other components of fossil fuel production, e.g. extraction, transport, and processing, should be considered in the comprehensive development of sustainable energy policy. That is a very polite way of saying you don't get to ignore the source of coal in considering the harm coal does. So, with all due respect to J.D. Vance, I think this hillbilly will continue to process a little bit of blame for the people who are causing those 1,200 adjusted deaths per year. Because it's pretty much all we have. There won't be any trials for coal company executives for killing innocents, whether they be elderly or middle-aged or children or babies in the womb. There won't be any homicide indictments, murder, negligent manslaughter, intentional, voluntary manslaughter, involuntary manslaughter. There won't be any trials. The judicial system is set up in such a way, and we have been shown time after time by the federal judiciary, that nothing that the federal judiciary will in no wise step in to protect the innocent, that they exist to provide cover for the extraction industries. And so memory becomes the only justice, the only recourse. Yeah. So we better have some blame. Else we'll have nothing at all. I don't see any other alternative for, you know, the hillbillies. Yeah. Do you? So, there we are at the close of the first hour of the program. And, let's see, a couple of announcements. Courtesy of Bob in Texas. Thank you, Bob. A challenge. Since we are down to $243 for our fundraising goal this evening, Bob has offered up $100 and asked, and so there will be $200 if someone else will match $100 coming in. So Bob's challenge is on the table, and thank you very, very kindly, Bob. Because we're running out of days in August, and we're getting very, very... And so far, it's looking pretty hopeful for beating the Swede for the eighth month in a row. Thank you, Bob. $100 challenge on the table. This is listener-supported conversation radio. Want to engage in the conversation? Yeah? Well, multiple methods, multiple means. The Stress Line, named for the immortal Bill Mr. Stress Miller, 304-663-4676. That's 304-663-HORN. Works better for some than for others. Don't use a speakerphone. Don't use Bluetooth on that line. 304-574-8178. That works well. And apparently, it even works with, like, Bluetooth. If you've got a really good Bluetooth, like Tracy does. Tracy, you'll have to tell us at some point in time what kind of Bluetooth you're using, because it comes across pretty nicely. And then, of course, Skype to Skype from anywhere on planet Earth for free. Bob Kincaid Horn, BobKincaidHorn. Bob Kincaid Horn. And so that'll get you in, and that'll get the conversation going. Being a Tuesday, we, of course, also have the Green News Report, courtesy of Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen. That's on the way, too. We'll be back. I'm Bob Kincaid.
Today you blasted near my street, and my house cracked at my feet. I can't help it if my home is in your way. Politicians by your side, they look so satisfied. I can't help it if my home is in your way. Promises you made amount to stealing. As a giant rock lands on my Chevrolet, suddenly I got that lawsuit feeling. I can't help it if my home is in your way. Know that the sheriff's lips will kiss you. Now, where they kiss you, I can't say. We're asking for a big injunction issue. We can't help it if our homes are in your way. No, we can't help it if our homes are in your way.
The black water looked almost like thick pea soup, but it was black. And those releases became more numerous. And I would talk to some of the workers that worked for this coal company, and they would make remarks to me such as, have you ever thought about moving? You know, that dam's going to end up, that pond's going to end up in your yard one day. Might wipe you out.
It's Tuesday, August 23rd, 2016.
National media fiddle as Louisiana drowns.
Media criticized for their slow response to Louisiana flood disaster.
You are going to see clusters, which is what we're seeing here now.
Louisiana floods could accelerate spread of the Zika virus, plus a tale of two Arctics. A tribe is forced to move while luxury cruises are just getting started.
It is the best of times. It is the worst of times. All of those tales and more straight ahead. From bradblog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Nobody knows. You know, clean coal. Look at what's happening with China. They're not cleaning it.
No, they're not cleaning it. I don't even know what to say. This is your Green News Report.
Believe me, they're not cleaning it.
Okay, Desi Doyen, over the past week between the presidential election madness and the Summer Olympics, it seems that there were no mainstream media left, I guess, to cover what was going on in Louisiana, this amazing flooding that, to your credit, you were on from day one.
And you're not the only one who's noticed, but we'll get to that in a moment. First, President Obama traveled to Baton Rouge, Louisiana on Tuesday to personally view the destruction wrought by a biblical deluge and record floods that have now killed at least 13 people and damaged now more than 60,000 homes. The American Red Cross called the disaster the most impactful since Superstorm Sandy. More than 100,000 people have now registered for federal disaster aid. Now, despite multiple advanced warnings issued by the National Weather Service, the corporate media really didn't cover those warnings and was slow to respond to the aftermath, raising the question of whether naming that land-based storm like a hurricane might have helped focus the media's attention amid this weird election year. On CNN's Reliable Sources, host Brian Stelter criticized the corporate media for ignoring not only the disaster, but also for not connecting the climate change dots.
It's got to be connected to climate change. It's got to be pointed out that there is evidence that these are happening more often due to climate change and are more extreme due to climate change. And if we're not there in the early stages, it's harder to cover that later.
So it takes naming a storm? What the hell kind of media do we have? You have to give it a name, a cute name, before they'll bother to notice it and report on it?
That's a good question.
Man, I kind of thought, you know, the worst flooding in hundreds of years and tens of thousands of people
dislocated would do it, but I guess not.
The Louisiana flood disaster is already fodder for the 2016 presidential campaign. Louisiana Governor John Bel Edwards had asked the president and other politicians to not visit right away so as not to divert resources away from the response. But right-wing media was already criticizing President Obama for not arriving sooner, and Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump showed up anyway to hand out supplies from the back of a donated truck for a few minutes.
Of course he did. The criticism here being that, oh, George W. Bush was criticized for not going right down to New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina struck in 2005. And I guess right-wing media thinks the American public has a very short memory. The criticism was not that George W. Bush didn't go down there right away.
It was that the federal government botched the response.
Yeah. In a big way. So, heck of a job, right-wing media.
The recovery in these disasters continues long after the cameras are gone, and now the National Institutes of Health has added a new threat to that aftermath. So much standing water in Louisiana could accelerate the spread of mosquitoes carrying the Zika virus across the Gulf states. Here's NIH Director Anthony Fauci in an interview with ABC This Week.
I would not be surprised if we see cases in Texas and Louisiana, particularly now where you have the situation with flooding in Louisiana. There's going to be a lot of problems getting rid of standing water.
Finally, a study in contrast from the rapidly warming Arctic, where sea ice this year is headed for yet another record low annual extent. The land beneath the island village of Shishmaref, Alaska, is
where?
Shishmaref.
Oh, okay.
It's dangerously eroding because of the loss of protective sea ice and melting permafrost below, thanks to the rise in global temperatures. Last week, in a town-wide vote, the 100 or so Inupiat Eskimo residents of Shishmaref officially voted to leave, to relocate their entire village to the mainland, and will seek federal emergency funds to do so. Mm. But it's a party for those who can afford it. A mega cruise ship has now set sail, the first ever mega luxury liner to navigate the once fabled Northwest Passage, which is now open because of that melting sea ice. Tickets started at $22,000 each, not including a mandatory $50,000 insurance policy to cover emergency evacuation in the remote region, a possibility that is so monumentally difficult, the U.S. Coast Guard has been running emergency search and rescue drills in Nome, Alaska, to be ready just in case.
So another upside of climate change.
For the rich, sure.
There you go. Glass half full, Desi Doyen. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find us and follow us on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Soon we'll be making another run. The love boat promises something for everyone.
Oh, yeah. Gotta love me some Lounge Lizard music. Yes, indeed. And thank you very kindly to Bill. We are now only $75 away from meeting Bob's $100 challenge. So, yay. Thank you very, very kindly, Bill. Three more at 25, one at 75, yada, yada, yada. Yes, I mean, when we can. And once that happens, we'll be only $43 away from making up ground from last night. Okie dokie. And by the way, for those of you interested, Tracy's Bluetooth is the Jabra Extreme 2. She says, I've been through several gizmos over the years, and this is the best one so far. Jabra Extreme 2. Because we like to keep track of things that interface nicely with the technology that goes into the creation of this program. Jabra Extreme 2 Bluetooth thingamajig. Yeah. Gizmo. What's this? Right. Let's see. since we started with a couple of journalism critiques for this Titanic Tuesday, note came in from Carol Baker, Queen of the Minions. Ah, journalism. I can't merely object. Now I'm howling. But I love Ken Burns' tweet in response to this dick. I'm here to support teachers, not to replace them. And of course, since the magic D word has been deployed, you just know that Carol must be referring to a Republican. Why, yes, as a matter of fact, she is. And, you know, with good reason. Not just any Republican, but a particularly odious jackass from Wisconsin. I'm speaking, of course, of Ron Johnson, the guy who 6 years ago defeated Russ Feingold for reasons that continue to evade me, and then went on to, embarrass himself. So consequently, in the Cap Times of Madison, Wisconsin, this headline: critics howl in response to Ron Johnson's call to replace college instructors with videos. Mm-hmm. And what this has to do with, and Ron Johnson is exactly as Carol described him. He appears to be losing to Russ Feingold in his bid to retake his seat and demonstrate that to some degree or another, the people of Wisconsin, the citizens of Wisconsin, have begun to return to their senses. And he uttered this little gem the other day. If you want to teach the Civil War across the country, are you better off having, I don't know, and he really doesn't, tens of thousands of history teachers that kind of know the subject, or would you be better off popping in 14 hours of Ken Burns' Civil War tape, and then, tape, he's still using tape, Ron Johnson from Wisconsin, he works in the lumber mills there, does. And then have those teachers proctor based on that excellent video production already done, Johnson asked at a luncheon forum hosted by WisPolitics. Well, first of all, Ken Burns really did change the face of documentary making with that Civil War series, and it is still touching and moving to watch, but it lacks a lot. It misses a lot of critical analysis because you can't do the entire Civil War, even if you've got 14 hours to work with, and Ken Burns doesn't pretend that he did. But Ron Johnson believes in bullshit stuff like charter schools, and he's never met a teacher he didn't despise, you know, if they were a member of one of those goddamn unions. Randy Weingarten, who is the president of the American Federation of Teachers, an actual union for teachers as opposed to like these state education associations, said, leave it to someone from a party led by a reality TV star to confuse videotape with the learning experience of a classroom. What Ron Johnson doesn't get is that education happens when teachers can listen to students and engage them to think for themselves. And that can include using Ken Burns' masterful work, but this is typical for a party with an education agenda as out of date as Johnson's, burn right down to the ground. As out of date as Johnson's blockbuster video card. Oh, that's good. Scott Ross with One Wisconsin Now said, we know Ron Johnson graduated from college 40 years ago, but we assumed it was from a university here on planet Earth. Not only does Ron Johnson oppose common sense measures like student loan refinancing that would immediately reduce costs for 515,000 hardworking Wisconsin borrowers, but he apparently thinks the solution to the nation's higher education student debt crisis is getting rid of diplomas and watching more television. Oh, my God. And then entered the fray Ken Burns, tweeting, "I'm here to support teachers, not replace them." But see, the right wing despises public education, because when you have good public education, it is much, much harder to have Republicans. Because Republicanism, in its present manifestation and current sense, feeds on, you know, ignorance, the stupid. Just like Republicans win elections when nobody shows up except Republicans. And high turnouts run counter to that. But it's Titanic Tuesday. Okay. By the way, Carol also recommends, since we're in a Bluetooth discussion, the Blue Parrot 350. She says it works splendidly, too. I've gotten to where, since I've entered my geezerdom, I just turn on the speaker of my phone wherever I am and don't give a damn and start screaming at it. Sometimes it's just more convenient to be a geezer. But it is. It's Titanic Tuesday. And we've got some restaurant quality Republicans for you. Full steam ahead. So down in Newton County, Georgia, they want to build a place of worship. Some Muslim people want to build a place of worship. Now, I'm not exactly sure where Newton County, Georgia is, so but I'll bet Steve in the chat room knows. Let's see here. Yeah, okay. Kind of north central of the state. Covington is the county seat. Ooh, I bet it gets hot and muggy down there. But they've got enough people of the Muslim faith there that they would like to have a new mosque. Not asking the government to build the mosque for them, or any good God-fearing, upstanding, Bible-believing, Christ-centered, evangelical, fundamentalist, amosexual Georgians to build the mosque for them. No. They just want a decent place to worship. So naturally, being as how, you know, our democracy and all the freight that goes with that, they had them a public hearing there in Covington. Yeah, people with their funeral home fans and their sweet tea come out to it make it. Yeah. So, let's check in, shall we? Let's check in with the public hearing in which citizens of Georgia calmly and politely and civilly discussed the issue. Because, see, let's just be clear, they don't have packed room public meetings when, say, the Church of Christ wants to build a new gospel sharp tabernacle, nor a public meeting if the Baptists want to put a new bowling alley next to their basketball court. Hell, they don't even have a public meeting if the folks there at B'nai Cracker want to build a new synagogue. But you know how it is with them Muslims, right? Mm-hmm. So let's travel now to Covington, Georgia, shall we? Oh, do let's. Okay, this is going to take a minute. Flash. Here we go.
Rages over a plan to build an Islamic cemetery and mosque in Newton County.
Chris Hopper was there for tonight's packed meeting. He has the details.
Guys, tonight we heard a lot about religion, terrorism, and fear. We heard some about traffic and congestion this development might cause, and we heard very little support for this proposed cemetery and mosque in Newton County.
Hoo-wee, listen to them white people hoot and holler. My goodness gracious. By the way, the people concerned about traffic congestion, they don't show up for traffic congestion hearings on Walmart or a new Fred's. No. But, well, you know, it's all those dynamite trucks pulling into the mosque there that's going to cause the traffic congestion problems. Oh, but goodness me, on the video here, I got an old white man with green galluses on over a blue plaid shirt. Looks like a whole bunch of pins in his pocket. This could be good.
As you can hear there, the crowd was very loud at certain points. There were two public hearing sessions tonight. 600 people packed inside this old courthouse in Covington. 3 hours of public comment centered on a proposed development of an Islamic cemetery and mosque in a rural part of Newton County. The group owns this property. They have plans to build. Newton County zoning laws and federal laws allow it, but based on what we heard tonight, people here want it stopped.
Now hold on a damn minute. The Muslims already own them some of Newton County, Georgia? The flag is a-falling. You know what? I bet it's going to be one of them 9/11 mosques. Oh, for God's sake. And I mean, this is like a megachurch thing. You know, it's not Wednesday yet, but still. No, and it's not Monday, and these are morons. No, it's just titanic expressions of God-fearing, upstanding, Bible-believing, white-wing intellect. The megachurches often have two services every Sunday morning because they can't quite wedge in all the credulous suckers. I mean worshipers. So they have to have multiple pastors and multiples. And well, damn. 600 people done showed up in Covington, Georgia to make sure that there ain't no ungodly Islam there in Newton County. Well, it ain't about the First Amendment. The First Amendment don't protect no Muslims. They weren't no Muslims in America back when Jesus handed down the First Amendment from Mount Sinai to little James Madison. First Amendment applies to freedom of Christian religion, you understand? Jesus.
We have already seen bombings and beheadings. 8 years ago, our U.S. government got a Muslim president who has put Muslims in power.
So it's hard for folks like me and probably most of you tonight to draw the line between innocent Muslims and radical Muslims.
Whew. Oh, my God.
8 years ago, the Muslims installed a Muslim president who has put Muslims in positions of power. Well, thank you, Marbleen. We'll see you at church on Sunday. I like this guy, too. It is hard for me to tell the difference between an innocent Muslim and a radical Muslim. Wonder if he has any problem telling the difference between a decent Christian and a Christian like himself. Well, yeah, because, you know, them other Christians, the ones that like gay people and Muslims and stuff like that, they ain't really Christians. Holy... Wouldn't you I'd love to have the raw tape of all of this. Tape.
Based on what we heard tonight, people here want it stopped.
I gotta hear it again, I'm sorry.
We have already seen bombings and beheadings. 8 years ago, our U.S. government got a Muslim president who has put Muslims in power.
So it's hard for folks like me and probably most of you tonight to draw the line between innocent Muslims and radical Muslims, since they all claim to serve the same God and they all claim to follow the same book.
So it really bothers me that I'm labeled a bigot because I just question it. That shouldn't be. Because I don't care if they come and worship, but I do care if it's 135 acres worth of a very large development.
Now, I mentioned there was very little support.
What's that clanging bell back there? Is that the bell clang to the Muslim prayer? Oh, wait, no, that's the bell clanging to Christian prayer. And what's that from Doris Jean back there about how she cares if they use 135 acres of property in that prime development? They own it, Doris Jean. Remember? Merca? Property rights? People can pretty much do with it as they please. Would you be concerned if it was 135 acres for the apostolic tabernacle and herpetological sanctuary? Would you, Doris Jean? And since we're kind of on a journalism kick this evening, this report comes courtesy of News 11 Alive, eyewitness team coverage there for you news. Once again, prime example of bullshit duality. Well, they may be right, but they may be wrong. Both sides do it. Mm-hmm. Just a note to 11 Alive there. It's actually okay to say that it's ignorant and fearful and bigoted to impose standards upon one community that you would not impose upon yourselves. Out of those 600 people that showed up, lo and behold, a moment of common humanity. One woman stood up, identified herself as Jewish, and said, if this discussion was happening 100 years ago, there's a good chance it would be happening to my people. And 100 years or so ago, millions of people, my people, including my great aunt, were sent to their deaths. Now, of course, that was just for killing Christ, but... It is an agonizing level of stupid, and these guardians of the fourth estate, 11 Alive, can't even quite muster up the courage to call out bigots in their own community. 11 Alive Atlanta, holding the powerful accountable. A Tegna company. Tegna? What is that backwards? And get. Nope, doesn't spell anything backwards either. Holding the powerful accountable. Not in Covington, sunshine. Not in Covington. All right, let's run over and see what's on Jim's mind. Hey, Jim.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, you?
Pretty good, I guess. Going back to this flood thing in Louisiana.
Yeah.
Did you see that pig, that senator from Louisiana, who voted against sending any type of relief to New Jersey during their hurricane?
Oh, not just one senator. It was several members of their delegation, both House
right.
and Senate.
And yes, and he was squealing like a stuck pig for the same relief for himself and his constituents that he denied for others,
mm-hmm.
or tried to deny.
Yeah, and the same thing happened when God dropped a tornado on Oklahoma, and they had voted the same way. But you know, as their book says, and they cried out, "Lord, Lord."
Well, there it is, and there you have it. What can you say to people like that?
I think you can tell them to. I don't know. Jim, I think what you do is you say, we're going to send the money. We're going to make sure it gets there. And I don't ever want to hear anything about fiscal responsibility out of your heart. But no, we've got our president is entirely too nice for that. He doesn't, bless his heart, Barack Obama is cool, and he can use some rapier wit from time to time. But he doesn't have any in-your-face Harry Truman about him.
Well, that's just a difference in personality.
I suppose it is, but wouldn't you like to hear these bastards called out once in a while?
Oh, I would indeed, absolutely. Just like Harry Truman called out Drew Pearson when Drew Pearson made some kind of nasty comment about his daughter playing the piano.
Yeah, Harry Truman called him a son of a bitch.
No, he did more than that. He threatened to come over there and whip his ass.
I do know that he publicly referred to him as a son of a bitch, and... Drew Pearson then founded the SOB Club.
Well, I can guarantee you one thing. If Harry had gotten a hold of him, Drew Pearson would have probably gone to some hospital. Because that's one thing you didn't do with Truman was to make comments about his wife or his daughter. And we need some a president like that with guts. But not like this asshole, this blue-haired orangutan Trump, who went down there, and God only knows what he was distributing, probably MREs that were made in 1962.
Well, I mean, we know that he personally distributed Play-Doh, Jim.
Oh, well, I don't know what... Play-Doh?
Yes,
you
sir.
You mean the toy?
Yes, sir.
Well, I thought he'd at least find, you know, at surplus some of these MREs that were made in 1962 that were the same MREs that were given to me when I was on Air Force survival training in the jungles of Charleston, South Carolina, down in Hellhole Swamp. And by the way, they were winter MREs. That's probably what Trump would have given them. Son of a bitch.
Well, he showed up with a truckload of stuff that he claimed that he had, that claims were made he had purchased himself. No, that could not be verified.
Well, in the Washington Post, running a type of inquiry on that, a fact check?
Yeah, and they got told to piss off.
By whom?
By the governmental officials in Louisiana. Well, I mean, they didn't say piss off. They just said, we are unable to verify what the source was on that. And the Trump campaign ain't talking.
Well, I guess they're not, because number one, the whole thing is a goddamn lie. Number two, why should the people in Louisiana be able, or the whatever government they have down there, be able to tell the Washington Post what to do? If they have the facts, they have the facts. And if they have the facts about Trump's mission of mercy down there, well, why can't they apply the same justice that was applied to Richard Nixon and his Watergate business? Of course, it's not the same Washington Post now, is it? I think the Washington Post, who owns it now?
Jeff Bezos of Amazon.
Yeah, Jeff Bezos. Yeah, that figures, yeah.
Libertarian, well, libertarian right-wing type.
you don't have Ben Bradley or Katherine Graham there anymore. They've gone to, I hope, their truly just rewards. But as far as Trump going down there, you know, how long was he there? About 15, 20 minutes?
29 was the count I saw.
Well, I hope he didn't get that thing on his head wet.
if it got wet, it'd run in somewhere for shelter.
Oh, it probably he'd probably look like, you know, he was I don't know. He probably would look like he had a real bad case of jaundice.
Well, God knows, he's got a great big persecution complex. He's convinced that he's been the victim of a media smear for the past week.
No, that's really funny when the media put him where he is now.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm not kidding. I mean that was the tweet that he sent out here. I got it right to hand. I'm pretty sure.
Well, he didn't tweet. He wasn't tweeting too much in protest when they were giving him all that free publicity and this, that, and the other when he was just totally outrageous.
No, but they can't completely keep him reined in because Trump's going to Trump, just like he went on a little mini tirade threatening to expose the dark and sordid secret relationship between Morning Mika and Morning Joe. And so now, let's see, here it is. The tweet reads as follows, Jim. It is being reported by virtually everyone and is a fact that the media pile-on against me is the worst in American political history.
Did you see Morning Joe this morning?
No.
Well, they had James Carville on there. And that asshole, and I put it on my Facebook, the WHOLEASHOLE, Joe Scarborough, was the biggest asshole that ever was on TV. And I just put it on my Facebook that, you know, depart and stand not upon the way of thy going, you son of a bitch.
Well, what'd he do to poor Snakehead?
He wouldn't even let the guy talk. He just kept talking over him like he wasn't even there.
Well, that's because he knew James Carville could whip his ass.
Well, no, I don't think so. I think James Carville showed admirable restraint because...
Oh, no, I mean rhetorically, in terms of argument and counter-argument. Thrust, parry, and riposte.
Now, you know, I'm no great fan of the shenanigans that Bill Clinton has pulled. And we've talked about that before. But, you know, I don't know what this business is with the Clinton Foundation and Bill being given $17.5 billion as a chancellor of World University. That's just stuff I hear snippets of. And maybe you can elaborate on that because you're better informed with all that stuff than I, because, well, I just get to the point where I have to just switch it off. But, I mean, you know, it's just a hell of a mess. It really is. Now, Trump's pulling out all the dirty, nasty stuff he possibly can. And that's his modus operandi. It has been ever since he hit the market in New York. I remember his actions in New York because I had friends who lived in buildings that Trump and his father took over, okay, when they moved over from Queens. And those people who had lived there for years were evicted. And in Trump Tower, when he built that, and took it over, that the rent went up, I don't know, like 10 times on the people who were living there. I mean, this guy is just a complete sociopath. And the only thing he wants to do is, number one, enforce his own reputation. And that's because he really has no sense of self-worth, real self-worth. It's all compensatory behavior, and he's dangerous as hell.
Yes, and yet I see postings from people.
Well, if you think Trump's dangerous, my God, Hillary's twice as dangerous.
Well, listen, let me ask you something. What's the state on this business about them going in? Now, he's called for a Ken Starr version of, another Ken Starr version of the Clinton Foundation. Now, my understanding is the Clinton Foundation, and I don't know the inner mechanics of it. I don't know who the hell does. But I understand they've done a lot of good. Vaccinations.
Well, there's two different entities, Jim.
One
is the Clinton Family Foundation, and the other is the Clinton Global Initiative. They are, as I understand it, separate and distinct legal entities.
Okay.
The Clinton Global Initiative is the one that's done the AIDS work and the philanthropic work in the developing world, that kind of thing. The Clinton Family Foundation, however, is for people out there who operate on a financial level that is far above the pay grades you and any pay grade you or I will ever see, have tax dodges, legal tax dodges.
Oh yes, in the code.
And these foundations are one of them. For instance, when Hillary Clinton released her tax records, which, of course, Trump has not, it indicated that Bill and Hillary's chief charitable contributions, and they made a sizable chunk. Well, their charitable contributions were to the Clinton Family Foundation. And see, inside the Clinton Family Foundation, I'm sure there is legal language that allows, for instance, for the little Mizvinsky kids to never have to work a day in their lives if they don't want to. And so that's the grandchildren of Bill and Hillary. And there's probably enough money there to make sure that the great-grandchildren and the great-great-grandchildren and the great-great-great-grandchildren never have to work a day in their life if they don't want to. It'll happen outside the tax code. It'll happen outside the inheritance taxes. And that is how, that's one of the mechanisms by which wealth perpetuates itself transgenerationally in this country.
Well, I guess so, because I understand that the current figure that they have generated for themselves is $100 million.
I'm not sure of the exact financial particulars, but
that was reported today. For what the report is worth, who knows? It could go up, it could go down. The way it's handled, who knows what to believe anymore?
So, you know, you can see it from coming from a mile away. If Hillary Clinton wins the presidency, there will be an immediate congressional investigation of the Clinton Foundation.
Oh, well, I'm sure there will be. There'll be more than that,
and it will run concurrently with an investigation. Another investigation of Benghazi. And that will run concurrently with an investigation of emails, and it will all culminate.
It's going to be another Watergate.
No, it's not. No, because there was something to Watergate. It's going to be another. It's going to be another Whitewater.
Well, you know, Bob, they don't have to have real facts to start this stuff. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Now, I know Nixon was guilty as hell when he lied and obstructed justice.
Nixon was a filthy little criminal.
But what I'm trying to say is, it doesn't necessarily have to be true for them to make it true in the eyes of the American people. Because these people up there, this Congress, and by the way, what do you call a group of baboons?
A troop?
It's a Congress.
No, I thought it was a troop.
No. It's a Congress, just like Pride of Lions, or a murder of crows.
Well, then what's it? What's
a group of baboons is a Congress.
Then what's a troop? There's something. Maybe it's a troop of orangutans or a troop of chimpanzees. Okay, it's a. I'll take your word for it.
Well, that's what we have up there, and it is truly a Congress of baboons, and that's exactly what it's going to be after 8 November.
And see, that is going to consume. Because you know when you can't win with a frontal assault, you have to fight delaying actions.
And oblique strategies.
And you have to harry by attempts to at flanking offensives.
Well, it's called.
But you know all this
strategy stuff.
I mean, you know the tactics of maneuvering.
Oblique strategies.
And the whole point is going to be to keep Hillary Clinton from getting anything done that the GOP does not approve of. Now, here's the funny thing. There's going to be plenty of stuff that the GOP approves of. We're not going to have a rewrite of Bill's 1996 welfare reform. We're not going to make life better for people in the most downtrodden fringes of this society. You know, look at what we deal with here in Appalachia. I can't help but reiterate, Jim, that in the 8 years since she ran for president the first time, Hillary Clinton hasn't said a blessed word about all the scientific evidence that's been developed that shows that Appalachian people are being poisoned. Not a damned word.
Well, they're not important to her because, number one...
No, we're those people.
You have a state with 4 electoral votes.
5.
You have a state... 5? I thought it was 4. It was 4 back in 2000.
No, 2 senators and 3 congressional districts.
Okay, 5. 4 or 5. But still, it's not economically, in the political sense, important to her. That's it. I mean, you know... Of course, now, if it came down to it, like it did in 2000, West Virginia, if they'd gone for Gore, Gore would be president.
That's absolutely true.
So, I mean, you know, a little hush money can do a lot of talking. And unfortunately, that election is something I'll never get over, the way that was stolen and the consequences of the wars that we got into because of W.
I don't even think, well, I've said it before, I'll say it again. I don't even think 9/11 happens if Gore is president.
Probably not. I mean, you know, Bush was giving at that very same time to the Taliban, the people and Osama bin Laden's crowd. And I'm not sure if this
$50 million.
$49 million. $48 million,
and that's my final offer.
$49 million, Bubby. 49. That's what the expenditures were. The so-called freedom fighters. Well, they got their money's worth, didn't they?
Well, actually, the money was paid out in appreciation for the success that the Taliban had in eradicating heroin production, opium poppy production, because they were very effective. They went in and, you know, chopped the heads off of opium farmers. Defanged the warlords.
Well, look at the production of opium now. I understand they're doing quite well. And a number of families in this country are quite satisfied with the
results. That's one of the things. You know, we talk about the opioid epidemic, and we talk about the heroin epidemic, but, you know, none of these geniuses in the for-profit media that I'm aware of ever look up and say, gee... You know, you never used to hear about heroin, but now it's all over the place. Where are all the, I mean, are they hiding the opium poppy fields out in Kansas somewhere? Hell no. Mm-hmm. They're in, once we bombed the Taliban out of the way and got Hamid Karzai, the former Unocal pipeline acquisitions executive in there, then happy days were here again for the opium farmers and the warlords.
Well... And I'm sure Karzai, if he's ever overthrown, will have a very safe berth in Switzerland or something.
Oh, he's
like
gone.
That.
He's gone from office now.
Yeah, well, it's a wonder he's still there because, I mean, you know, I'm surprised he hadn't been assassinated because those people, a lot of people do not care for him in Afghanistan. But, you know, the main thing about it is the hypocrisy and the stupidity and the absolute lying that has been done and covered up. And it's not even covered up. I mean, hell, the Nazis did a better job in covering up their crimes when they were retreating from the Russians than these people have.
Well,
I mean, think about it, Bob.
Well, but they got nothing to cover up. They're proud of it.
Oh, they got plenty to cover up, buddy. Plenty. You don't know.
Why should they? It's not like the people who vote for them are going to stop voting for them and start voting for liberals or progressives or anything like that. I mean, I've got a quote here, and you know, she doesn't even qualify for the program anymore. But Anthrax Coulter has screeched that there's no hope for any Republican ever winning another election unless Trump wins the presidency. And that you know, that's just so much hysterical horseshit, Jim.
Oh, I wish it were true.
Well, sure, but I mean, you and I both know that they're not going to start electing Democrats in the Confederacy or anywhere that the Confederacy's disease has spread.
Oh, it has had a definite metastatic influence, and a lot of people have been completely hoodwinked by Donald Trump because he's good at that. But I remember when he first started. Over the past 12 months, and I thought I would never see a presidential candidate or a man trying to gain public office behave the way he did. But these idiots loved it. Kick them out. Kick them in the ass. Fuck them. And, you know, that's on tape. That's a matter of public record. He didn't give a shit because he says he has $8 billion, I doubt if that's true. Because this man is an inveterate liar. And the truth is not in him or anything he says he's going to do. He speaks in antonyms, he speaks antonymically, and anything he says he's going to do, he's not going to do. And anything he says he's, well, you know exactly what antonymical speech renders, do you not?
Absolutely. He's one big wad of projection.
Right.
Anything that he complains about in someone else is something that he himself has contemplated or committed.
Well, you know, he copies these things, but he does so poorly. I mean, it is totally, at least to me, transparent. And it's not in the least way opaque, not even opaque. He just comes right out and does it. And he just says all this stuff, and now he's taking this new tack, this new course, in which he's trying to be a kinder, gentler, well, I've said this, now I don't know about this, and maybe I had going to have to... retract this or this, that, and the other. You know exactly what he's doing. And in the meanwhile, with his oblique strategies against the Clintons, and God knows they're no paragons of virtue for all the stuff they've done. I mean, it's just like a big, I don't know, for the lack of the better term, a hog wallow or some type of political cockfight.
I think a cockfight has a little bit more dignity, Jim.
Well, I'll tell you the truth, I can't afford them that dignity. Because I'm just totally, you know, totally disappointed. I mean, truly, Bob, the captains and kings have departed. And the empire has been brought low. and other nations in the world look at us and they say, is this the best that your system can produce?
And the answer, with regard to either candidate, okay? No, let me expand on that, Jim. And the answer with regard to Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton, Jill Stein, and Gary Johnson is, yeah, sorry. The statesmen are the statesmen, and I'm sorry for the gender, the genderishness of it, is gone from American politics. And has been for a very long time. Bubba was no statesman. W certainly wasn't. Pappy Bush was not a statesman. Neither was Ray Gunn.
But you know, I'll tell you one thing. I worked for Reagan. I worked for Bush 41. And I worked for Clinton. As a federal employee.
Yeah.
And I saw the stuff that they were pulling. Remember last night I sent you that email about Clinton's reinventing government thing?
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, you're absolutely right. It's not like he hit his ideas.
Well, you know what bullet one of that document was? What he wanted to do?
What?
Get rid of the Army Corps of Engineers.
Well, I'm, you know, there's lots of places on in this country where the Army Corps is nobody's friend, and they don't have fans. But toward what end?
What else we have? I mean, you know, they do serve a useful purpose.
Well, then everything that the Army Corps does would be done by the much vaunted and sacred private sector.
Well, exactly. But Bush 41 didn't want to do away with the Army Corps of Engineers.
No, good God, no. If he'd said something like that, he would have had a riot on his hands inside the GOP.
I'll tell you one thing. You know, I like Bush 41. He may have done some stupid shit. He may have said some things like read my hips and not being able to read a barcode or what it was in a grocery store or that and the other. But, you know, Bush 41, I could tolerate, but not the shit that Bill Clinton pulled with his welfare reforms and his absolute, not prevarications, just lies. But, you know, he said he was going to do it. I saw the Red Book today. I've got it, had it stashed away, and I just couldn't bother to read it. But I did get to the first page and see the first bullet about how he wanted to do away with the Army Corps of Engineers, how he wanted to decimate the Federal Civil Service. That was one of Clinton's big things.
Well, sure, and then there was the great base closing frenzy.
Right, absolutely.
That was the post-Soviet peace dividend. Remember the peace dividend?
Mm-hmm, sure do.
Well, that didn't. That didn't last as long as a fart in a swamp, did it?
No. Anybody who had any foresight could see that there were other things on the horizon that would be just as dangerous. As a matter of fact, more dangerous, because at least back during the Cold War, you knew what the Soviets were up to. They knew what we were up to. And it was a game that they played. And they played it very well.
And there was a certain assumption that they could sort of be trusted not to just go mad and use one.
Exactly. Exactly. As a matter of fact, when we had this mishap with Soviet radar depicted inbound over their country, it was a Soviet lieutenant colonel who, before calling the Kremlin, rechecked the equipment, re-verified that these were errors in their system. I mean, they had no more to gain from a nuclear holocaust than we did. And the Soviet strategic rocket forces were under centralized control. And you had responsible people.
Meanwhile, this month, on the Korean Peninsula, I don't know if you caught this or not, but the North, because this is that time of year, thou mayst well in me behold, this is that time of year when American troops and South Korean troops march back and forth just a little bit south of the DMZ, which just pisses the North Koreans right off. And, of course, they had a recent high-ranking North Korean defection to the south. And so with the military games, exercises coming up, the North has announced, you know, we don't mind nuking you at all. One false move and we'll light you up. See, in our nice civilized European Cold War, the Soviets didn't do that.
No, they didn't, because they knew exactly what war was like. I mean, they had been invaded. That country has been invaded so many fucking times by the Tatars, the Varangians, all these people.
Don't forget the Swedes.
Yeah, Swede Charles, yeah, and Peter the Great. Well, I think Peter the Great whipped his ass. But they knew exactly what war was like and what it would do to their country. And they realized there was no real gain to profit from them. I mean, with Peter the Great, at least he got his window on the Baltic, one of the most beautiful cities today.
Oh, by the way, completely an aside, Jim, and for anybody else too. I was on Amazon Prime the other night, and I ran across a movie I would probably never have clicked on, but I found it delightful. I mean, not delightful, but a damn good watch. It's simply called The Pirate. And it's the story of a pirate, a Greek, by the name of Vavrakis, who fought in the Greek Revolution against the Turks, and then signed on with the Russian court of Catherine.
Mm-hmm.
And she made him an admiral. He made a fortune. And the whole story was very enjoyable to watch. And it featured in two significant supporting roles, John Cleese and as Catherine the Great, Catherine Deneuve.
Oh, she's wonderful.
And it wasn't, you know, a pirate movie in the sense of, you know, Jack Sparrow and a lot of crap going boom, but it was a very, very engaging period historical drama.
Well, you know, the Russian czars had a motto as far as bringing people into their country to modernize it and make it better. And their motto was Shushede Kapapla, find the capable. And the ancestors of the Lord Byron of Russia, Alexander Pushkin, His ancestors came from Africa.
Yep.
And if you go to Pushkin's study, you will see on his desk a paperweight of a black man holding a cotton bale. But they weren't treated as a slave because Ibrahim Hannibal, the one that was brought in, the ancestor of Alexander Pushkin, who wrote some of those beautiful stories and poems that you'll ever read.
Pushkin is beautiful, even in translation.
Was
I assume he's black. Yeah, I assume he must be even better in the original.
Well, I mean, you know, they say that when you go through the translation or the transliteration in the translation, you lose a lot, and you really can't understand how things. For like Chekhov, you can't do Chekhov in English, because it doesn't mean the same thing in English as it does in Russian.
And yet, but the number of productions of The Cherry Orchard out there, and it, you know, it comes across pretty nicely. The same thing can be said, of course, of anything in translation, but and it relies on the translator's art. I love the English translations of the Japanese novelist Murakami, and I can only imagine what Gabriel Garcia Marquez must be like in the original Spanish, because 1,000 years of solitude and love in the time of cholera just, you know, blew my doors off.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And
I mean, I got, and I can proudly say I got through Anna Karenina. But I've never gotten Jim, I have never gotten through War and Peace.
Through what? War and Peace?
Yeah.
That's a difficult read.
That's just, I mean, well, and the same can be said for I've never gotten through the Gulag Archipelago either.
Well, that's a difficult read, too. But I've gotten through that. I've gotten through Cancer Ward. I've gotten through, let's see, One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich. Of course, that was just basically a monograph, you know, a monograph or a pamphlet compared to the others. But, yeah.
And this coming from somebody who did manage to claw, slog, scrape, scrap, gouge his way through Ulysses. So,
yeah, I've got James Joyce right here on the reading table. I've never really, I don't know how far I got into it, but just couldn't do it. But one thing about Anna Karenina, that was based on a true character.
Yes.
Who was a tutor and advisor to Nicholas II.
I'll be darned.
Sure was. Who had been cuckold. And his name began with a P, probably the North Steph or something like that. That's his name. You can look it up if you want to. But it's based on that man's marital career, and, or shall I say, lack of a marital career because of his wife who falls in love with Count Pronsky. But I've taken too much
it's
of
the,
your time.
It's the sigh that makes that final remark, Jim. I give you cowbell for that.
Well, I've got a lot to sigh about, to tell you the truth. But, you know, I'm one person who is absolutely disaffected and discollected about the things that have been going on with so many things and in this country. I just haven't been very vocal about it because we don't talk that much. But nonetheless, you've got other people that you want to talk to. I'm going to get off here, but I enjoyed our little discourse on at least the ability of the Russian monarchs and the czars to find good people to do good things, and Catherine the Great was one of them.
And there is no truth to the horse story, right?
No, she was a very enlightened person. I mean, she had come from a minor German province and had to deal with that awful husband of hers, Peter the Third, and they took care of him. And after she gained the throne, she made good business out of what she did. She was a very wise woman and did exactly what I would have done. She expanded Russia, huge cotton lands, huge lands and stuff like that, and made Mother Russia what it was.
Yeah, you mentioned Peter the Third. You mentioned Peter the Third, and I was going to say they fixed his little red wagon, but that's a little bit out of time frame.
Well, yeah, they did.
Jim, have a good evening. You take care.
Well, you too.
All right. Bye now. Yeah, see what I did there? Little red wagon. Yeah, I'm proud of myself. 13 minutes past the hour. And a reminder, thanks to Bill, we have only $75 to go on Bob in Texas's $100 challenge this evening. So hopefully we will make that. That'll happen. That'll happen in, say, maybe the next 46 minutes, could it? Maybe. And that way we'll go into prayer meeting Wednesday without having to pump everybody up with extra strong sweet tea and then lock the doors. People hate it when we do that. By the way, looking into the chat room and seeing that our buddy V.T. Blom is there, a very happy birthday to you, V.T. Blom. I hope you have spent the day happily, and thanks for spending your birthday evening with us. Thank you very, very kindly. By the way, little details get people going. It turns out that, yes, the venery term for a group of baboons is, in fact, a troop. Thank you very kindly, Carol, and thank you very kindly, Flavio.
It's Punky calling in with his translator, Scott.
And Punky says, in a huckleberry hound dog howdy to you.
Absolutely.
You said something in the conversation with Jim, which was, the conversation was quite good.
Thank
but
you.
Something that you said, or maybe Jim said,
did
or
I
maybe
screw
you
up?
Said. Huh?
Did I screw up?
No. My little ears perked up. And I said, hey, I meant to talk to Bob about this a while back and got sidetracked. And what that thing was the peace dividend. And I have a question about the peace dividend. It's a fanciful notion, I think. But I wonder, more and more, did it ever exist? And if it ever existed at all, it probably wasn't long for this world, owing to the fact that we're all of us, by and large, are little chess pieces on an international board that are moved around by unseen hands. And the object of the game has nothing to do with us, except to the extent that we have some utility for the people who own the unseen hands that are moving us all around the great chessboard.
Oh, yes, the unseen hand of the free market.
Well, no, but it's the unseen hand of the people who actually have a say in what happens and what doesn't. And it was certainly not in their best interest, these purveyors of chess moves, to allow something like a peace dividend to exist, because it defeats their entire purpose for being.
Well, it's not good for business.
Well, no. Business, arms, armaments, global real estate, power, prestige. Hell no. The last thing they want is for a peace dividend to exist. And that ushered in the 9/11 attacks, because that presented us with a brand new enemy, a big old new boogeyman to be afraid of, and to pour untold trillions of dollars into defeating, fat chance. Okay, because terrorism is a technique. It's not a tangible thing. But, and speaking of 9/11, and I meant to bring this up, I posted about it on my Facebook, and you may have seen it, you may not have. A couple of weeks ago, when Rudy Giuliani talked about in the 8 years preceding the arrival of Obama, there was never a successful Islamic radical act perpetrated in the United States. Now, this is odd, coming from a guy who was mayor of the very town in which the most cataclysmic attack ever occurred. Okay? That's selective memory. That's blinders. That's something. But it ain't reality. And as it happened, around the time that Giuliani made that remark, I happened to see a movie that came out a few years ago called Charlie Wilson's War, about the Texas congressman who single-handedly made sure that the Mujahideen, which were fighting the Soviets who had invaded Afghanistan back in the late 70s and into the 80s, Congressman Charlie Wilson of Texas single-handedly made sure that they got funded and fitted out with weaponry that would cause the Soviets to go away. Okay? Now, one of the big supporters, both financial and with manpower, of the Afghan patriot group,
Mujahideen, against, yes,
yeah, against the Soviets, was Osama bin Laden. Okay.
Well, yeah, because Al Qaeda began as a sort of a relief agency for injured Mujahideen.
Yes. Okay. So, in the wake of the Soviet retreat, after being financed and heavily armed by Charlie Wilson and his like-minded people, there was left a political and social and religious vacuum in Afghanistan, and we know that nature abhors a vacuum, okay, that was quickly filled by Al-Qaeda. Now, meanwhile, Giuliani, back in the 80s, was a Justice Department attorney who tried to bring cocaine use charges against Charlie Wilson and some others. So you might be correct in saying, had Giuliani done his fucking job back in the 80s as a Justice Department attorney, he would have caused Charlie Wilson to be tried and convicted, thus losing his seat in Congress, thus being not in a position of funding the freedom fighters against the Soviets in Afghanistan. And perhaps the vacuum wouldn't have occurred because the Soviets would have stayed, and 9/11 may very well not have happened.
But not only that, but in more prosaic terms, Scott, if you recall the end of the film, the Tom Hanks film, by the end of the film, you know, the strategy has worked and the Soviets are on the run. And Charlie Wilson goes back and says, okay, now we need a few million dollars for schools, roads, infrastructure, and to set up civil society.
Yeah.
And the administration and the rest of the Congress look at him and go, what? We just won. Sit down and shut up.
Yeah.
And he says something, if I recall correctly, about, so we're gonna win the war and we're going to lose the peace.
Yeah, and the powers that be saw the Soviets leaving as the end of the story. And Charlie Wilson had sense enough to know that that wasn't true. And for a couple of million more, a lot of this shit could have been avoided. So anyway, that's, the peace dividend. What's your take on that? Did it ever exist? And if it
no,
did,
it was a complete fraud. It was just a means of shuffling money around. With the military industrial congressional complex was never going to let us shake out the sofa and just see how much loose change poured out, you know, to the tune of trillions of dollars. God damn, really? No. Because when you get right down to it, the military industrial congressional complex has become a larger and larger and larger and larger share, Scott, of the last few places where America actually manufactures anything.
Mm-hmm.
And so we don't dare tear it down. I mean, it's a little bit like the conversation I was engaging in last night, in which I was talking about the theoretical versus practical realities of turning off the hydrocarbon spigot. If there was some way for us to stop burning hydrocarbons tomorrow, it would yield a net positive in the long term. But in the short term real world, it would be a sentence of death for untold millions of people in this country and around the world, depending on how many people turned the spigot off.
Yeah, and that would therefore jeopardize the future existence of the thing that we look at from afar as the long term actually occurring.
And so, once again, it's a similar circumstance, because if you were to gut like it desperately needs to be gutted, the military industrial congressional complex budget, then a whole lot of people wind up out of work. And I mean, I'm sort of intimately familiar with this concept, because I've had it slapped in my face like a 12-day-old mackerel in the heat for well over 10 years now, talking about mountaintop removal, Because you say, you know, we got to end mountaintop removal in Appalachia because people are being poisoned and killed. And the response is, yeah, but what about our jobs? We need to keep killing people so we can have a job. Well, how the hell is that any different from needing to keep bombing brown people benighted, broken-hearted little corners of the world so that somebody can have a nice middle-class existence in Connecticut or California or Washington or Florida or any of the other states of the Union? Because the genius of the military-industrial congressional complex is that practically every congressional district in this country has an element of the defense industry in it. And not one congressman is going to step up and say, I want my plant in my district shut down.
Well, it's the nature of the way things currently are and have been back to even before Eisenhower in 1960, just before late 60, early 61, when he gave his little farewell speech and coined the term military-industrial complex, which, by the way, was supposed to be in the original script, military-industrial congressional complex. Let that sink in.
I doubt if even the peaceniks in San Diego want to see the Navy and the Marine Corps go bye-bye.
Hell no. We don't want to see Comic-Con go, and we sure as hell don't want to see the Navy and the Marines go.
Wow, okay, yeah.
But see, the very nature of the way things are and have been for a long time, the dynamic of the game is set up not unlike a long married couple, an unhappy married couple, who have been married a long, long time. They go into counseling, they quit drinking, they get their wretched act together, and there's no more serious conflict going on. Well, their whole basis for being goes away. And that key word there is conflict, because we're a conflict-based society. It's a conflict-based system. And without the conflict, you know, we operate out of there's never enough, okay? If the average everyday person wins $10 million in the lottery, after the initial euphoria wears off, in their heart of heart, in the dark of night, they think, well, what am I going to do when that $10 million goes away? You know, it's a mindset of lack. It's a mindset of I've got
money. Well, I mean, isn't the entire underpinning of capitalism the idea of created scarcity?
Well, yeah, that's what I'm getting at. That's what I'm getting at. So, narrowing it down, the focus of the conversation, to the results of the upcoming election, well, it's a choice, I think, not between Democrat and Republican, because that's not any meaningful choice as things currently stand. It's a choice between more of the same or radical change, something new, something different, something better. And it doesn't matter which one it is. They could both turn out to be as benign as Dwight Eisenhower, you know, who believed in unions. You look at the 1956
GOP. Ask the Iranians how benign Dwight Eisenhower was.
Well, no, I'm talking about in terms of domestic tranquility, and it was typically for many, many, many people, the 1950s and into the 60s were a golden era for a lot of damn people in this country. And in the 60s especially, things began to get somewhat better for those who were not in on the golden era. You know, I mean, Hillary and Trump could turn out to be modern-day reincarnations of Eisenhower in the sense of the great times, everybody's working, we're actually making stuff. Or it could continue as it's been going.
Did you say Hillary or Trump?
Yeah, I kind of think so on some level.
Yeah, no. With Trump, the only way that happens is the same way that, you know, infinite monkeys with infinite typewriters, one of them winds up typing out Hamlet.
Well, some of my reasoning on to base that on, that notion, is I've kind of thought in the back of my mind pretty much all along that he said all the crazy, outrageous things that he said to get nominated in the hopes of being elected, okay?
Yeah, but Scott, hold on. Time out. He was saying that crazy shit back years ago. I mean, he was the birther in chief.
I know. But how many times, even in radio, have we said things to stir up the listeners and stir up the pot?
Well, God, I hope I don't.
To achieve a better end, okay? Well, you know, you want to be nice or be honest.
Well, I mean, I'm trying to think of any time that I've tried to just create controversy for the sake of controversy. I mean, I know it happens out there, but mostly when I hot up the mic here, you know, I'm not needling anybody, and I'm not trying to get anybody worked up on one side or the other.
Well, maybe I phrased it inartfully. Okay, try this on. Could it possibly be that sometimes the discussion veers into a for lack of a better term, a victim mentality, in the sense that people may have more say in what goes on than they realize, but if they don't realize it, things will stay the same and we'll have stuff to talk about. And hell, I'm as guilty of this as anyone. Jesus. I mean, it's that old thing. As you travel through life, no matter what your goal, keep your eye on the donut and not on the hole. And 9 times out of 10, I'll be looking at that damn hole. But that's a side issue. And that just could be the fact that I'm full of it from time to time, which is also a well-established.
Well, let me just take this moment to affirm that is not and never has been my goal here.
Oh, I know. Believe me, I wouldn't listen to the show if I didn't see worth and value and importance to it, because time is too well, you've said from time to time, thank you for spending a portion of your limited time, finite time. Exactly.
It's part of the reason why there's no ads here. The for-profit media is a delivery vehicle that is meant to deliver potential consumers to potential sellers. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
If you happen to enjoy the content that's wrapped around the commercials, well, that's part of the game too. You sit through that, and as part of the deal, you get pitched at by, you know, fill in the blank.
Yeah, because the commercials pay the freight for the rest of it.
Well, not even so much that, Scott, as simply, it's the purpose. The purpose is not the delivery of content. The purpose is the delivery of consumers to sellers.
Well, yeah, in the commercial realm, yeah, definitely.
I mean, nobody started a broadcast. Over-the-air terrestrial broadcasting was not started by altruists or philanthropists. It was started by people who saw a way to make a dollar. I mean, it's capitalism, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, that's how media is done in this country. I don't know about other places, but that's how it's done here. That's one of the reasons it can't suck enough, by and large.
I mean, we've got case in point, that clip I ran from NBC 11 Alive Atlanta, holding the powerful to account. Well, that's a slogan, not a mission statement.
Mm-hmm.
Because they didn't even have enough guts to say that every single person who stood up to speak out against that mosque was spitting on the First Amendment to the Constitution of the United States, because every person who stood up to speak against that mosque was doing exactly that. But they didn't have the courage to say that because they would have been flooded with complaints, even in a place like Atlanta. And the next thing you know, there ain't no advertisers. And then Tinga, or whatever the name of the holding corporation is, has a fire sale to get rid of Fox 11, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Do you see my point?
Well, yeah, because, you know, if you lose the car dealership ads, that's one of the things that a lot of these local stations thrive on. Just the revenue from that, losing that would be enough to jeopardize the status of the station remaining, at least in those hands. Like you said, they'd have to sell it off in a fire sale.
So, I mean, I'm kind of at a loss. You got a little pushback from Steve in China. He says, say what? You must realize only a middle-class citizen of a post-industrial wasteland can be concerned with the arithmetic of winning the lottery. The vast majority of the world's destitute are too busy just surviving. The few who control the wealth don't give a shit about chump change. Wise up, people. Regards, Steve in China.
Wait a minute. Run that by me again, because I'm not exactly sure what he's saying.
Only a middle-class citizen of a post-industrial wasteland can be concerned with the arithmetic of winning the lottery.
Wait a minute. Is that presumably me?
Oh, that's us. That's Mirka.
Oh, okay.
Remember, Steve's writing from China.
Okay, because I haven't been middle class for...
The vast majority of the world's destitute are too busy just surviving. The few who control the wealth don't give a shit about chump change. And that's in reference to your $10 million. And you know, there's truth in that, Scott.
Yeah.
Because just watch the sales numbers on Mega Millions or the Powerball when the numbers start getting up. And the funny thing is, it used to be this way when it was getting close to 100 mil.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. But now, so it was Mega Millions that was up pushing $1 billion maybe a year or so ago. And when the buzz about it got sufficiently pervasive, you know, usually if you buy a ticket for the Tuesday Mega Millions on, say, Saturday, the amount of the Mega Millions amount on Tuesday will remain the same from Saturday to Tuesday. But when it got up into that thin oxygen, where it was approaching $1 billion, the actual amount of the jackpot started ticking up on, in some cases, an hourly basis.
Oh, yeah, and people in neighboring states to places that didn't have the lottery, states that neighbor places that did, in those border towns, they would flock over to the state that had...
Absolutely. But the point here is that those middle-class citizens of a post-industrial wasteland that Steve in China refers to, I mean, dig it. They only went out and started buying tickets when they thought that the jackpot amount was sufficient to justify them dropping a dollar or two or three or whatever it is.
Okay. All right.
That's a level of clueless avarice that's really kind of shocking to contemplate. You won't buy a ticket when the jackpot's been knocked all the way down to 15 million. Yeah, because that wouldn't get you through. Well, but by God, you'll start buying when it crosses the $500 million mark.
Yeah, and it's also kind of telling that the mindset for those who buy these tickets, and I'm among them from time to time, is such that they see no other viable way, long shot though it may be, to that type of success in today's American world.
Well, and that's largely because for a tremendous number of people in this country, that is the only way. And then, you know, from time to time, you get the stories of the winners.
Oh, God.
Like in this state, and it's the reason I'm convinced that we will never have another multi-million-dollar Powerball winner be allowed in West Virginia. Several years back, a guy named Jack Whitaker, who was already a millionaire,
won what was at the time the largest Powerball jackpot in history. And he did it on Christmas.
I think I remember that story.
And so he shows up on the Today Show with his black felt cowboy hat and his typhus is out. And he talks about how he's going to give a whole lot of the money to the church. God bless them. To help the children. Well, it wasn't very long before there was a report of him being knocked off or knocked over, you know, robbed in the parking lot of a little joint called the Pink Pony down in Cross Lanes, West Virginia, which was a lovely little church. No, it wasn't a church. It was a strip joint where people lissome young women took their clothing all the way off down to nothing. And he was known for carrying around a briefcase full of, you know, wrapped $100 bills or whatever. And then he went out and he bought cars for everybody. And, you know, he turned into an Oprah for his family, bought his granddaughter. And then his granddaughter got herself hooked on some sort of godforsaken drug and disappeared. And they later found out that her boyfriend had hid her body in the woodpile under a tarp for, you know, a couple or 3 months. And then the serious boys started coming after him because they said he was deadbeaten on debts that he had run up in Vegas. And in the meantime, he was being sued by workers' comp and various contractors because that's what he was. He was a contractor, and he'd been deadbeaten all along on his employees and his comp payments. And then, of course, how did this turn into a conversation about the lottery, Scott? There was the decidedly underreported story out of Iowa from last year where it turned out one of the guy who was like the head of computer security for multi-state lotteries that runs Powerball and Hot Lotto and several others, well, he got caught rigging the game. And his particular favorite was a game called Hot Lotto, because it doesn't have big jackpots and it grows real slowly and nobody pays attention. And it turned out that he was involved in a scheme whereby he would provide somebody the winning numbers, and they'd buy the ticket, and then lo and behold, an offshore corporation, if I'm recalling all this correctly, an offshore corporation would then cash the ticket. You see, when you're the chief of security for multi-state lotteries or whatever their name is, you're not even allowed to buy a ticket.
Yeah. Well, how we got on the lottery has to do with the example that I gave to hopefully point in the direction of the concept of people operating out of a mindset of never enough. That's how we got on the lottery, and that's just happened to be the example I used.
Yeah, there's a conceptualization, and that goes back to what I was talking about people who will buy a ticket at $500 million but won't buy one at $15 million. And that's not a critique of people. You know, look, the lottery is a voluntary tax upon the unreasonably optimistic. That's what it is.
It's good to know I'm unreasonably optimistic. I had thought I had left optimism behind many, many moons ago.
But the thing is, there's a conception that, you know, $15 million just isn't that much money anymore. When, to use Steve and China's metrics, you can't count the number of lives that would change in most of the world. That's food for life. Not for one person, but for thousands.
I don't mean to bitch, moan, and complain. I am literally approaching the last week of the month, okay? And my budget right now, my net worth right now in terms of money in the bank or money available, literal, not counting the British pound coin and a couple of pesos I've found over the years that I carry around, is 15 cents. So never mind 15 million, never mind 15 billion. Today, as I sit here, 15 bucks would make a difference. So yeah, I get it. I get that notion of it all depends on where you're sitting and what your circumstances are. And I'm fine. I mean, I'll make it through the end of the month. And I won't have to fricassee the cat or Punky to do it. Okay?
Oh, speaking of which, I got to tell you. So I watched the movie Trumbo the other night.
Oh, wasn't that good?
I don't know what took me so long. I don't care how good Leonardo DiCaprio was in The Revenant. Bryan Cranston got ripped right off.
Exactly.
At the Academy Awards. He absolutely should have had the Best Actor Oscar. But that's not... No, it's the scene where Trumbo first meets Otto Preminger.
Mm-hmm.
And you remember he's got the little parrot on his shoulder? Looks like a
cockatiel. That's a cockatiel.
A gray one?
Yeah, I used to have a Trixie was a gray cockatiel.
Okay, because there's a white one in the...
I'll have to watch it again. I'm pretty sure it was a cockatiel.
But he says something about my daughter, because there's a white cockatiel in a cage or whatever.
Yeah.
And Trumbo says something to Otto Preminger like, yeah, my daughter thinks she can save all the birds, can end all the birds' misery. And Otto Preminger replies, so do I, by broiling them. And I had one of those "Don't look, Ethel" moments when I was like, "Jesus, don't let Punky hear that."
No, I'm very selective about what he's allowed to see on TV for that very reason.
Well, he's an impressionable cockatiel,
and he's mystified. A while back, I videoed on the phone, and then posted it on YouTube. One morning a few weeks ago, he was singing, and I videoed it. And I've got this Roku box, which lets me see my YouTube stuff on the TV. And Punky will sit on top of his house, his cage, which I call a house because nobody wants to live in a cage. And I'll fire up that little video of himself singing, sitting on my shoulder. And he'll sit there and he'll look at the TV and he'll start singing along with the bird on the TV. And he won't quite get that it's a TV. And it's actually him, but he likes to have a little birdie friend. I know he's got several in the various mirrors around the house. Well, we've come a long way from the peace dividend. I guess the moral of the story is it never existed because it cannot be permitted to be, simply because it's not in the nature of the system to allow it to even be thought of, because if you get people thinking from the structure's point of view, thinking is a revolutionary act. Hell, speaking is an even bigger revolutionary act.
Yeah.
Now I just need to get Punky to learn how to say all power to the people and raise his little bird. Well, he doesn't have a birdie test. He has birdie feet.
Just one little claw, about 45 degrees in a fist, will do fine.
Now Trixie, his late mate, Trixie the cockatiel, knew how to do impersonations of powerful political figures. When I originally got her, I thought she was a him, and I used to when I thought he was a him, she was a him, was Tricky Dick. Because she'd put her little wings up above her head and lower her little birdie head and puff out her little birdie cheeks. And I tried for years to teach that bird to say, I'm not a crook. But I never could do it. She would just look at me.
Well, there are some things up with which a cockatiel will not put.
And that may be one of those indignities.
Yeah. It's like the day that Hillary was shopping for a gift for Bill, and you know what do you get for the guy who has everything, right? And she was walking by a pet store, and there was this beautiful macaw, in the window, and it said, reduced for quick sale, $50. And she goes in and says, why such a low price? Is it old? Is it about to die? She goes, no, perfectly healthy bird. It's just that its last owner couldn't live with it because it lived a long time in a brothel. And all of a sudden, the macaw turns and looks at Hillary and says, who's the new girl? Who's the new girl? He goes, oh, I see. But she says, it's a bargain at $50. I'll take it home. So she does and gets the cage set up. And Chelsea walks in. And the bird turns to Chelsea and says, who's the new girl? Who's the new girl? And then Bill walks in and the bird turns to Bill and goes, hi, Bill. Hi, Bill. Yeah, maybe I already told that one. It's right up there with, okay, but tell me, what did the chicken do? That's probably my favorite.
Oh, the bald-headed bird?
Yeah, yeah.
Or the one that they punished by putting in the freezer.
Right, that's the one, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know what the fuck you guys did.
Okay, I'll behave, well, I promise, but tell me, what did the chicken do?
Or the one, the guy, this old couple, the wife was having trouble sleeping, so the guy went to the pet shop and bought her a canary, thinking that the singing of the canary would lull his wife into peaceful sleep. So he brought the bird home, and he noticed that the bird only had one leg. So he was rather indignant. I mean, he kept it for one night because the pet shop was closed. And the bird did what he thought, that he would sing, and the wife fell right off to sleep. But still, it was a one-legged bird. So he took it back to the pet shop and explained what was going on. And the pet shop owner said, well, what did you want, a singer or a dancer? You know, so. Which isn't quite as good as Who's the New Girl and Hi, Bill, but.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're tap dancing for time here. And speaking of time, I think mine is up.
Well, it's good. Always good talking to you, Scott. You have yourself a lovely evening.
All right, Bob.
And just a dandy evening to Punky, who we know actually does all the talking. You know, it's the punchline to another joke. The bird's a ventriloquist. He's doing it all.
Indeed. Yeah. Maybe there's a nature show on public television he can watch tonight to soothe him.
Well, as long as there aren't any cats or big cats or right.
Yeah. One night he was watching Letterman, and Letterman had one of the animal experts on who brought an eagle. The thing must have had a wingspan of 5 or 6 feet. And one of the trainers had the eagle up in the balcony of the Ed Sullivan Theater. And the idea they would give Dave on stage a chunk of meat and give a signal, and the bird would swoop down from the Ed Sullivan Theater balcony over the audience onto Dave's arm to get the chunk of meat. Well, Punky, again, is sitting on top of his little house watching TV because he used to love Letterman. And that bird, that eagle, swooped down from the balcony, and Punky just about freaked out. He started shrieking. I guess on some level they know what a bird of prey looks like.
You're damned right they do.
But I hadn't.
That wasn't that. Entertainment. That was a horror movie for Punky.
Oh, Punky did not like that. He did not like that at all. And it taught me not to show him TV shows with big birds of prey swooping down.
Speaking of which, one wonders how he thought of Sesame Street, but we'll leave that for another time.
Well, I don't let him watch that. It's Warner Brother cartoons or nothing.
Yeah, because, you know, I can just... Big bird? You did no fucking shit, Dad. Yeah, that ain't no bird. Kiss my ass. Scott, you have yourself a good night.
All right, Bob. Take care.
You too. Bye now. Going back to the whole nuclear threat thing, a note coming in from Steve in China. You're a little bit behind the curve. Sham war and the end of freedom. You're a little bit behind the curve on the current question of nuclear confrontation or the daily environment of readiness in general. I have no doubt.
Though the numbers are certainly classified, it is safe to say that the U.S. and everyone else with nuclear commitments manages to avoid at least one alert or instance of initiating automated warfare every single day. The idea that our nuclear oversight consists of a bunch of many-starred generals standing around in a big room and actually deciding to start World War III is more of a product of Hollywood and political rhetoric than any sort of reality, however insane. You can bet your ass human beings merely monitor the computerized threat scenarios these days and abort the machine decisions when it is determined that a false alert has been issued. It was this way decades ago when I was in the military, and has only become more positively a question of making critical action decisions rather than perceiving or otherwise responding to a threat. Makes you sort of wonder, are we serious about preventing the ultimate conflict, or could we be more serious about what the gamesmanship of nuclear confrontation is really about? Total corporate power. Both of which somehow seem to be, feel, right terrifying. Oh, and it's not just every day that we have a Titanic story on Titanic Tuesday, so we'll close with this. A story coming from Agence France-Presse. Lawsuit filed by Premier Exhibitions in a Florida federal bankruptcy court. Premier Exhibitions controls thousands of artifacts salvaged from the Titanic. In the bankruptcy case, the judge denied Premier permission to sell some of the Titanic artifacts, including jewelry and clothing, in order to pay off its creditors. In point of fact, the bankruptcy judge said the French government could still retain some rights. Didn't say they did, said they might. Some rights over the first batch of some 2,100 artifacts recovered from the Titanic by a Premier subsidiary together with the French Maritime Institute, Ifremer. And so, who knows, maybe those Titanic salad tongs are in the collection. And so, France is being called upon by the court to clarify whether it claims control over any of the artifacts. And so it remains to be seen what will happen. Interesting little piece of legal wrangling, though. Interesting that the judge would... how about that? Just for the sake of perspective. Consider, a bankruptcy court took into account the potential rights of a potential absentee co-owner of recovered wealth from the wreck of the Titanic under the bankruptcy laws of the United States. But the same bankruptcy laws of the United States blithely zero out and liquidate the pension rights of working people who have given their entire working lives to corporations. What was that phrase that Steve just used? Total corporate power. And so we will close this evening with $75 to go on Bob in Texas' $100 challenge. I hope it gets met. And, well, we may have to bolt the doors shut in the Cathedral of Common Sense after all. Didn't want to do that. Thanks, everybody, for joining in for this Titanic Tuesday. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff. Thank you to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Good night, y'all.